death falls out of the sky evenly across the metropolis of London, there is a something resembling a straightforward clash between good and evil going on there. Didn't have to be. It's the capital city of a white supremacist empire resisting fascism. It didn't have to do it, but it kind of, it wobbled onto the side of the angels. And I remain helplessly moved by that.
It's Shelf Life, and on this episode, I'm joined by Francis Spufford to talk about his new novel, Nonsuch, a Blitz-era love story and metaphysical thriller where wartime London tilts into the uncanny and the fantasy of changing history comes with a moral price tag. We'll also trace the book's companion syllabus through John Crowley's Four Freedoms and W.H. Auden's September 1st, 1939, a poem written as the world tipped into catastrophe. That's Shelf Life after this.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. Three American service members were killed and five were wounded during the joint U.S.-Israeli attack on Iran. A U.S. official tells NPR those killed were ground-based troops, not on a ship or a warplane. As NPR's Luke Garrett reports, the Pentagon says major combat operations continue.
United States Central Command reported the first casualties of the operation Sunday morning. The attack against Iran started the day before. On Saturday, Iranian state media confirmed the death of Supreme Leader Ali Khamenei. Iran vowed retaliatory strikes and launched missiles. President Trump warned Iran against revenge, threatening on social media the U.S. would, quote, hit them with a force that has never been seen before. Central Command did not say when or where the U.S. troops were killed and seriously injured. It did report that several other soldiers sustained shrapnel injuries and concussions. Those troops are returning to duty, the Pentagon said. Luke Garrett, NPR News, Washington.
Israeli authorities say at least 9 people have been killed in an Iranian missile attack in central Israel. Police say the missile hit a building being used as a shelter. Yesterday, a missile hit central Tel Aviv, killing one person. Iran says its former president, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, has been killed in airstrikes. It's the latest death announced by Iran after the killing of Iran's spiritual leader yesterday. NPR's Jane Arraf has details.
Iran's state media showed Ahmadinejad's portrait framed in black and said he was killed along with what it called a number of his companions in a rocket attack by Israel and the United States. It gave no further details. Ahmadinejad served as president from 2005 to 2013. He was a strong supporter of Iran's nuclear program. Meanwhile, Iran's current president, Masoud Pezeshkian, said in a message on state TV that a temporary leadership council is now at work following the killing of Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. The 3-person council will govern the country under Islamic law before a panel of Shia clerics chooses a new spiritual leader. Jane Arraf, NPR News, Amman.
European Union ambassadors are holding an emergency meeting on the conflict in Iran today. They're calling for a negotiated solution between Iran, Israel, and the United States. An investigation is underway in Austin, Texas, after an early morning shooting in a bar. Police Chief Lisa Davis says police responded to a report of a man with a gun.
This incident started with that calls for a male shooting at Buford's Bar on West 6th Street. Officers immediately transitioned, came over East 6th to West 6th Street, and were faced with the individual with a gun, and 3 of our officers returned fire, killing the suspect.
2 other people were killed. 14 people were hospitalized, 3 in critical condition. This is NPR News. Belgium seized an oil tanker today, believed to be carrying oil in violation of Western sanctions on Russia over its war in Ukraine. Officials suspect it's part of Russia's so-called shadow fleet, sailing under a false flag with false documents to evade the sanctions. They said it was intercepted overnight in the North Sea with the help of French forces. The federal housing agency, HUD, wants new restrictions on rental aid. NPR's Jennifer Ludden reports a proposal could impose full-time work requirements and a time limit of just 2 years.
The proposed rule is not a mandate. It would allow local housing authorities and private landlords to impose the requirements if they choose. Elderly and disabled tenants would be exempt. It's part of a push by HUD Secretary Scott Turner to promote what he calls self-sufficiency. Supporters also say there are such long waiting lists for rental aid, it's more fair to spread it around. Critics of the proposed rule say most people who can work already do. They just don't make enough to pay market rate rents. A few places have experimented with time limits, but dropped them because as the cutoffs approached, they worried they'd be pushing people into homelessness. Jennifer Ludden, NPR News, Washington.
At the Producers Guild Awards, one battle after another took the top honor last night. The drama already has won at the Directors Guild, the Golden Globes, and the BAFTAs. The movie is seen as a favorite to pick up an Oscar this year. The Academy Awards are scheduled to be presented March 15th. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Bayer. Bayer is dedicated to delivering breakthroughs that save lives and feed the world using the scientific process. Learn more at sciencedelivers.com. This is NPR.
Death falls out of the sky evenly across the metropolis of London. There is something resembling a straightforward clash between good and evil going on there. Didn't have to be. It's the capital city of a white supremacist empire resisting fascism. It didn't have to do it, but it wobbled onto the side of the angels. And I remain helplessly moved by that.
Hello and welcome to Shelf Life. I'm Aaron Hicklin. Hello. Francis Buffett's novels often arrive wearing one set of clothes: historical caper, wartime romance, alternate history noir, and then use those popular forms to smuggle in bigger moral questions that linger long after the plot is over. He is a writer with a scholar's appetite for systems, but a novelist's instinct for propulsion, someone who can make you care about the machinery behind money, belief, empire, or class without ever confusing the machinery for the point. You may, like me, have been dazzled by his debut novel, Golden Hill, in which a mysterious young Englishman arrives in 18th century New York with a bill of exchange so outrageous it destabilizes an entire small city. Or perhaps you first came to him through Light Perpetual, his book, a long-listed act of imaginative counter-history, or through his non-fiction, Read Plenty, his noveloid about Soviet economics, and Unapologetic, his bracing, lucid account of Christian belief, written by someone who has lived on both sides of faith. In this episode of Shelf Life, we're talking with Spufford about his new novel, Nonsuch, set in London at the onset of the Blitz, where ordinary life is already strange enough, and then the book tilts into the uncanny, turning wartime London into a stage for questions about time, power, moral compromise, and what it costs to do the right thing. We'll also look at two works that sit in the novel's shadow as inspirations and provocations: John Crowley's Four Freedoms, a wartime novel about ideals and private compromises, and W.H. Auden's September 1, 1939, that unsettled poem written as Europe tips into catastrophe, insisting fiercely on the difficulty of love and the danger of delusion. Francis Spufford, welcome to Shelf Life.
Thank you for having me.
Francis, your protagonist in Nonsuch, your fourth novel, is Iris. She's a spunky proto-feminist, sex positive, unwilling to be shamed by her desires, either sexual or material. She's a capitalist who wants to make money, but not for its own sake, rather in order to have power to be, in her words, in the room where the decisions are made. I'm going to steal from your author's note at the end of the book to summarize the scale of the novel. You describe it there as a daft mixture of wartime finance, early TV, archangels, Renaissance magic, and falling bombs. When did you realize these elements belonged in the same book?
The way I write, almost always, kind of things appear at different points around the horizon of my imagination and then gradually declare themselves to be ready to converge and to turn out to be the same thing. I'd had an idea for a thriller about 20 years ago about very early TV, because I'm just charmed by the idea of broadcast television before the Second World War seems so out of historical sequence, and I'm always very keen on that sense of a chronological glitch. The Angels and the early modern part were more recent, relatively speaking, but the incident that starts me off is the moment early this century when my grandmother, who was about 95 at the time and still very, very vigorous, was sitting with me in the oldest Indian restaurant in London called Vera Swami's. It's still there. And we sat down and she looked around and said, "I was last here in about 1935. It hasn't changed." And then she said, with no prompt whatsoever, "I always used to prefer going out with married men because they always spent so much more money on you." And then she clammed up, and whatever door had just opened a chink onto the interesting piece of bad behaviour she'd been engaged in the early 1930s, immediately slammed. And I have wanted to find a way at least to imagine myself into the world of a kind of interestingly unscrupulous and ambitious young woman. In fact, I moved her a few years later to the very end of the 30s and the beginning of the war, when the historical shadows are thickening on private life and private indulgences and private pleasures. And to see if as a 61-year-old man, I could find my way into the voice and perceptions of somebody 22, 23 and a woman operating in much stiffer and more patriarchal times than any I've experienced myself directly. And the television, the finance, the angels, the alchemists, they all just were pulled with magnetic force towards the central figure of my protagonist, Iris. It made perfect sense at the time, I assure you.
So much to unpack there. I mean, I love that idea of your grandmother being a kind of locus for this novel and for the central character, Iris, because it reminds me how, you know, how easy it is to sort of somehow disregard our elders' experiences and histories and stories. We sort of see them often as people who've always been old.
I think this is the advantage of turning 60 myself, that suddenly the thing that should have been apparent all along became clear, which is that old people have all been young already. They are repositories of, you know, impulsive 17-year-old experiences and brave 22-year-old experiences and tempered and more sober 35-year-old experiences. It's all packed in there. I knew this in theory. I'd read the bit at the end of Proust, where everyone is walking around on the stilts of their immense age. But it makes a difference when you realize it. And I suspect that as a writer, it makes time traveling back to youth easier, perversely. I feel less worried about trying to write as a 22-year-old now than I would have done a few years ago, perversely.
Well, the art of a novelist is, in a sense, the art of time travel. They are taking us backwards or forwards, or sometimes, you know, maybe staying in the present. But so often, the novelist's magic trick is to be able to take us through time.
Absolutely, which is one of the reasons why I think that the kind of the overtly fantastic in fiction is a kind of natural extension in some ways of what fiction is anyway. It's just a literal performance of the set of tricks which fiction is. It's the magic made overtly magical when it's always implicitly magical anyway.
It's funny, I don't always think of myself as someone drawn to fantasy, although I was a child who devoured Narnia. But I think what's so extraordinary about Nonesuch is the verisimilitude that you aim for. So fantasy operates as a kind of portal, really, for some fairly large questions, which we'll come to. But what you do so well here is imagine the London of 1939 and 1940, the London of the Blitz, and it feels very lived. And, you know, you don't wear that scholarly research too heavily. I feel I am being taken back to London during the beginning of the war and then into the Blitz. without feeling I'm being taught a lesson.
Well, you shouldn't be being taught a lesson. And I'm not sure, in fact, that scholarly is the right word for the kind of research here, because it is as interested in ideas and systems and historical explanations as scholarship is, but for very, very different purposes. And the reason that I always feel I'd be a fraud to accept the kind of compliment you're offering me here is that I know that when I'm reading, I'm skimming through material looking for the particular details or the particular ideas which make, you know, the narrative sections of my brain light up, and I'm leaving most of the other stuff behind. Fiction is a responsible art in some ways, because you need to feel that you are doing the most truthful kind of lying you can manage. But it's also an irresponsible art in that it doesn't have to be proportioned. It doesn't have to try to tell ever the whole story, which would be completely impossible in fiction. You are looking for the one thing, the one horrible wartime recipe that can stand for what it's like eating rationed food, for the one or two or three incidents that tell you how unearthly it is being in a city of millions with no visible lighting, so that walking through the streets is like, you know, in the most natural and non-fantastic way, like being put into a dark forest full of sharp metal obstructions and moving vehicles that may flatten you. They had far more road traffic accidents and casualties from them in the first year of the Second World War in London than they did casualties from German bombs. I think you develop a kind of a finder's instinct for knowing where the good stuff is. And it's not necessarily in the obvious good places. Things that are already arranged to move you in the historical record tend not to move you, whereas it's the speaking details that have been left in a category assumed to be boring that come out and bring the past alive. I have a largish appetite for apparently boring things anyway, or I would not have written a kind of noveloid object about Soviet economics. So in this case, reading through the regulations for confiscating American stocks and shares owned by British citizens during the war, which does not sound fictionally promising, kind of wakes and becomes interesting if you think, hang on, that means that young women in stockbrokers' offices had to write an identical letter to every single person in the country who owned an American share, put a stamp on the envelope, post them in huge bales, and then deal with the answers. And what you've actually got there is not a boring historical fact, but a kind of lively reason for real people to be bored. And then the office grows around the stamps and the people wearily typing exactly the same letter 500 times. And Iris, my protagonist, who would rather be out dancing in a Silver Mermaid dress or making money on her own account, is at the typewriter with her fingers sullenly writing, kind of, "Dear Mr. X, I regret to inform you." The details, if listened to patiently, if dug through with the right kind of treasure hunter's eye, show you the stories that could be told, I think.
Mm-hmm. Iris has such brio. She's funny, shrewd, armoured. What did her voice let you do on the page that a more classically virtuous protagonist wouldn't?
I wanted to avail myself of the freedom to write a kind of an unidealised female character, somebody who was allowed to be mixed, genuinely self-centred, sharp, but in a narrow way. Iris knows almost nothing about kind of art and culture, and what she does know tends to bore her, whereas she can rush through a book about stock dealing regulations. She's genuinely greedy, and she is allergic to being described as kind, because she recognizes that invitations to kindness where women are concerned are usually invitations to set aside your own needs in favor of taking care of somebody else's. When she is kind, it usually takes her by surprise. She thinks she likes swaggering, not very bright good-looking guys with money who you can have a good time with. The book records her irritatedly falling in love with somebody who she doesn't think is her type at all, and then discovering that Jeff, the male love interest, who is a kind of 1930s nerd, really, that there are advantages in his lack of socialization, although his naivety is hideously embarrassing. But there are advantages in somebody who has not imbibed the rules of this society fully, and who might just possibly be on her side when it comes to her scandalous desire to be rich and powerful. Also, this will bring us to the book by John Crowley I want to talk about later. There is a strange temporary utopia for young women in the Second World War. Dreadful things happen, death falls nightly from the air, but simply because all the men between, 17 and 46 have suddenly been conscripted and called up, the world is being run by women, and all of the rules which had seemed rock solid till then, which said, don't do that, ladies, don't do that, suddenly become optional, and the world bends over backwards to help you out. You want to work in a factory? Let us provide childcare. You've got to rush into a burning building? We'll give you 2 weeks of training as a firefighter. All of that. And that, too, in a way, like 1930s television, is out of time. It represents a kind of rip or rupture in the ordinary relationships of that time, which could be thought to be near to magic, or at least to make telling a magical story as well about those things be not too much of a reach, an extension, a way of using the tools of the fantastic to talk about the strangeness of a real piece of social evolution.
There's a delicious scene in the book where Iris escapes London for a night and stays with her friend Eleanor, a sort of shabby, genteel, bohemian friend of hers. Iris finally gets the sleep she's been denied in wartime London. And then she ends up in conversation with John Maynard Keynes. It's such a tonal relief somehow, witty, social, full of intellectual electricity. Let's hear an excerpt from the audiobook of that scene.
Miles Ormond was easing the cork out of a bottle of champagne, the second of the evening, judging by the glasses being held out by the two middle-aged men in penguin suits who were the other guests. One looked like a hamster, the other was more craggy. She took a deep breath and stepped across the threshold. "Good evening," she said, her voice full of Watford. This was a place, she judged, where what she had started out as would be found more interesting than any amount of Chelsea elocution. Faces turned towards her. Miles hurried over with a glass for her, and Eleanor saluted her at the head of a dining table by waving a large kitchen knife over the famous pie. "Do come and sit down, all of you," she called. "I feel you need to get the beauty of it hot." And in short order, Iris was seated opposite Hamster, being passed a mismatched plate loaded with a slice of pie, oozing savoury gravy and containing more meat than she had seen at once since January. Her mouth watered. From the other direction, Miles passed a tureen of mashed potatoes and another of buttery cabbage. "Oh, this is splendid," said Hamster, in a high, educated drawl. "Thank you so much, Ormond, for luring us down from the Treasury." "A pleasure," said Miles, "though the pleasure provider, you'll note, is really my wife." "Ah, wife," noted Iris. "Kyrie Athena Genetaira Piton," said Hamster, waving his fork, which Iris could make nothing of at all. "Do you really think the goddess of wisdom is responsible for pies?" asked Eleanor. "Sounds to me more like a job for one of the muses." "Hail, muse of pastry!" Laughter. "But how do you do it?" asked Craggy, indicating the spread. "Benefits of the countryside," said Eleanor. "Rabbit and pheasant in the pie, courtesy of local gentlemen of the night." "Poachers," put in Ormond. "Spuds and cabbage courtesy of our own vegetable patch. Butter from the farm next door." "It's delicious," said Iris, feeling that if she didn't start speaking, she might never do so. "Isn't it, though?" said Hamster. "Tell me," he asked politely, "are you from the world of the arts as well?" Iris opened her mouth, but Ormond got in first. "No," he said. "Miss Hawkins is finance, like us. but on the sell side, to use an Americanism. Cornelis and Bloom, confirmed Iris. Oh, yes, said Craggy. I was at Cornelis's boy's bar mitzvah, donkeys years ago now. How is he? Bearing up, said Iris. Harold's a POW. I'm sorry to hear it. Better than the alternative, said Iris. Indeed, said Craggy. And how are you finding things, business-wise? Asked Hampster. Well, said Iris, we called the bottom of the market correctly in June, so we're pleased about that, and so are our clients. But, as you gentlemen know, most of the ingenious ways we could profit from the situation have been blocked off by cunningly devised regulations. Thank you for that. She raised her glass to Hampster ironically. He nodded ironically back. Of course, I do support the reasoning, she said. The holes in the capital account had to be stopped. Oh, have you read How to Pay for the War? Hampster asked. Of course, said Iris. Are you a Keynesian too? Hampster laughed, revealing under his hamsterish moustache a surprisingly red and fleshy upper lip. It's an interesting point, he said. Sometimes I doubt it. After all, I believe Marx denied he was a Marxist. This is Keynes, said Miles Ormond gently. I'm sorry, I should have introduced you.
And that was an excerpt from the audiobook of Nonsuch, a novel by my guest Francis Spufford. It was read there by Lydia Wilson and is published by Simon & Schuster. Francis, we just listened to that wonderful scene from Nonsuch. Iris, your protagonist, is in the countryside with Eleanor, and she falls into conversation with John Maynard Keynes. What did you want to reveal about Iris in that scene?
That she is as capable as she thinks she is, that although she is intoxicated that evening by a combination of actual champagne, but also the largest meal she's had in months. So surging protein has got something to do with the way she rises to the occasion there. But also, I mean, I love Iris. I admire her a lot. And I wanted her to be the opposite of kind of out of her social depth. I wanted it to be demonstrated that if you gave this kind of remarkable woman the chance, she would just go for it and seize the moment. The book is partly about class in a way that I hope is legible at this distance of decades to American readers as well. It's about somebody from the suburbs who by rules of gender and rules of class and rules of kind of social hierarchy is not what people think of when they think about making the world's systems of power and money work. Watford, where Iris comes from, is, I suppose, it is New Jersey to kind of London's Manhattan. It's somewhere you come from and adopt the colouring required to succeed in Wall Street, which she's kind of managing to do in the exceptional circumstances of the war. But the momentary expansion of freedom that allows her to do that is caused by the fact that her city and her country are in a kind of vice grip of evil, that it looks at that point as if Hitler, having conquered the rest of Europe with shocking speed, is about to conquer England as well. So it's a very ambiguous kind of freedom. And on top of the prosaic political evil of the moment, which the Trotskyist Victor Serge described as midnight in the century, and it's not an exaggeration, I wanted to add a kind of fantastic dimension to evil there as a way of, well, apart from anything else, as a way of bringing us out of the kind of the tropes and the misleading sense of familiarity that we can have about the Blitz. It's a very narrated time, and I wanted to do something different with it that refreshed it and estranged it and made us see how strange it actually was.
Well, let's stay with that, because the overriding question in this novel is one that Doctor Who fans will recognise. What if we could turn back time to change a historical outcome? But your wrinkle is particularly bracing. The person trying to change the outcome is doing it in service of Hitler,
trying to remove Churchill before he becomes wartime leader, clearing the path for a very different kind of Britain. What was your thinking about revision as a moral desire, not just nostalgia, but also collaboration?
I wanted to bring out the strange confidence that fascists, including the British fascists of Mosley's British Union of Fascists, felt in 1940. They really did think that the tide of history was going their way. Mosley's lot ran candidates in elections calling themselves the Peace Party in early 1940, the war being all, of course, the fault of Jewish financiers. So from their point of view, everything was going absolutely according to plan up to the point where the narrative jumps its tracks because unexpectedly it's Churchill who becomes prime minister. And instead of doing the sensible thing and making peace with Hitler and keeping the empire and allowing the world to darken more than it was already, because it's the British Empire we're talking about here. Britain is not a hub of virtue, but this is the moment when something virtuous happens. And fascists, I think, were surprised and appalled at this point. So what I wanted was their indignant sense that they'd been cheated of something that they'd already had within their grasp. I wanted it to be palpable that they were kind of trying to do violence to a piece of time which had a horrible but kind of real integrity to it, that what was brave as well as awful about the year 1940, the idea of unpicking it and taking part of it out, there's a sort of rapist's logic there applied to time. I wanted the magic to seem genuinely horrible and the desire to kind of bully the universe to seem black in itself. Maybe that means I'm actually refusing some of the logic of fantasy, because it means that I'm treating most of the magic in the book as something coercive and evil rather than wonderful and enlarging. Though portals do open in Nonesuch, it's mostly fascists with their can openers trying to open them, and those who are on the side of the angels literally trying to keep them shut. Is that fantasy? I'm not absolutely certain. It may be using fantasy's tools to do something else.
The woman who is trying to turn back time so that Lord Halifax, more of an appeaser than Churchill, becomes prime minister instead, is called Lal. She's from the upper classes. And I think one of the great pleasures of the book, again, is that you frame this relationship between Lal and Iris as a kind of chess match between two women, an upper-class fascist who believes she's being reasonable, and a young woman with the wrong accent and a ferocious conviction that good has to win. Did you conceive that as a duel?
I did, as a duel and as a duo as well. Once I knew I was writing a book with a female hero, I knew I needed a female villain as well. And I knew that the strange temporary freedoms of the war had to apply to Lal. I wanted there to be a peculiar kind of dark version of Iris's freedom at work there. And I wanted Lal to be real enough to be changed by it as well. But they are opposites in some ways. One of them represents the class structure which is holding the other one down. One of them represents evil, and the other one represents the kind of warm-hearted mess of freedom. But they are also in some ways mirror images of each other. Lal is another person of will who will not let the world be as it is, but insists on trying to reshape it. Villains are quite often kind of the dark alter ego of heroes. And I knew that just as Sherlock Holmes has to go all the way to the Reichenbach Falls with Moriarty, the conflict between Iris and Lal needs to be pushed all the way to the end of the book, move by move. And that part of the kind of the ethics of the book have got to be a question about ends and means and about what is right and what is not right to do when resisting evil. I should be careful of spoilers, but there is a point where Iris pushes Lal off a roof in the course of doing something magical. And for a few seconds, she feels nothing but a kind of beat your breast warrior triumph. And then abruptly, the meaning of the scene changes and she goes, I'm on a rooftop, which I've just pushed someone off, and scrabbles frantically down to the gutter to see if she can retrieve her, which she can, more or less, only to get threatened again herself later. And I didn't want to take the step out of realism into fantasy, in which people suddenly lose all compunction about doing drastic things. After all, one of the extraordinary dimensions of the Second World War is that for conscripted soldiers and for a surprising number of women, the question about how far war meant you needed to put aside kind of ordinary morals was a pressing and live one. We are very strongly programmed, for very good reasons, not to push other people off roofs because it suits us. And that doesn't go away instantly because you find yourself in an urgent conflict, really.
Mm. You're listening to Shelf Life. I'm Aaron Hicklin. My guest for this episode is Francis Spufford. He's the author of Nonsuch, which has just been published by Simon & Schuster. Francis, let's talk about angels. Your angel, Raphael, is not a comforting presence. He's immense, odd, funny and infuriating, and always constrained by what he's permitted to say. These are not the angels we see on Christmas cards, are they?
They are not. They are not the pretty angels playing harps that we see in Victorian iconography. They are also, I'm glad to say, not the kind of angels you sometimes see in some fantasy novels who are kind of hunky bikers with feathers either. They are fairly biblically accurate angels. And if you look at the Bible, angels are either completely indistinguishable from humans, so you can entertain angels unawares, or so painfully different, they're scarcely comprehensible to the humans who see them. Ezekiel sees a kind of confusion of wheels revolving on the hillside. Isaiah sees smoke and many too many wings. And I thought the way to go here is a kind of Lovecraftian angel who is on the side of good, but is so other from human bodies that you'd get a migraine just looking at them, that there'd be something kind of deeply disturbing about their physical presence. At the same time, they can take on less oppressive shapes if you ask them to. And Iris, who is determined never to be intimidated by anything that is larger and stronger than her, does request that the strange fractal thing, which has turned up in her bedroom with more dimensions to it than your eyes can take in without an immediate headache, that it should dress itself up as something else. And rather than looking like a kind of Blake angel or a Milton angel, one of the quiet jokes is that what the angel actually then turns up as is Dr. Manhattan from Watchmen, only rather better endowed in order to tease Iris.
Mm-hmm. There's a fairly magical scene in the book that takes place in a church in Chelsea at Christmas. It's snowing outside. It's almost Narnia-like. The whole scene is beautiful, but not sentimental. I wondered, reading that, how faith might be an important lens for your writing.
I think a religious imagination, which I suppose I helplessly have one of, in some ways comes with liabilities that a secular one doesn't have. There are particular traps and sinkholes to do with piety or reverence or failures to fully imagine, which I'm very wary of. I mean, I am a believer, but what I believe the world to be is not directly and literally represented in Nonesuch. Nonesuch is a fantasy that uses narratively the architecture of the tradition that my faith comes out of. And as fantasy does, as science fiction does, it takes it literally. It assumes for story purposes that angels and archangels do this. But there isn't a kind of one-to-one mapping onto what I actually believe. And there is a freedom there, which seemed to me to be important for the book's construction. if you are a believer, it soaks through your fundamental understanding of what people are and how they work. I hope that this makes me more curious, more sympathetic, more open-minded. Christianity is a very anti-perfectionist creed for me, which ought to make you limitlessly sympathetic to all of the ways in which people are very much not perfect. And I try my best to work it like that.
You're listening to Shelf Life. I'm Aaron Hicklin. My guest is the author Frances Spufford. We'll be back after this.
New folk music is the power behind its development and innovation, and of course it just keeps on coming. From bands that have been around for many decades to first releases. So next time on The Waggaloda Monkeys with me, Graham Rice, here on Radio Catskill, it's New Music Monthly, a full hour of new folk music. Won't you join me Sunday afternoon at 3?
So here's the deal. Public radio is now operating without federal funding, and your support matters more than ever. One way to help is to donate that car, truck, or old motorcycle in your driveway. You clear out some space and help keep trusted news coverage alive in your community. The process? Simple, free, even tax deductible. Just head to this station's website and help us keep this work going together.
Donate your car, boat, or motorcycle at wjffradio.org.
You're listening to Shelf Life. I'm Aaron Hicklin. I'm talking with the author Frances Spufford about two of his favourite works. One, John Crowley's Four Freedoms, and the other, W.H. Auden's poem, September 1st, 1939. Frances, John Crowley sets his novel Four Freedoms in wartime America, not London this time, 1942 to 1945, I think, around a fictional aircraft plant near Ponca City, building the equally fictional B-30 Pax bomber. The plant's owners decide they can't staff it with the usual workforce, so they recruit the people the country tends to treat as expendable. Women, black workers, the old, the disabled, and even build a company town, Henryville, to keep the whole machine running. The title nods to Franklin D. Roosevelt's Four Freedoms speech, and the novel keeps testing those ideas against lived reality. Who gets freedom when, and what happens when the war ends and the emergency coalition begins to dissolve? Tell me why you chose John Crowley's Four Freedoms and what it meant to you.
I chose it because it's about the American version of exactly the period of temporary paradoxical freedom for women and everyone who isn't an able-bodied man who is usually who the world is organized for. Those things in London were what my novel Nonesuch was about. And this is the American version. Brilliantly realized, I think. The other reason I picked it is that John Crowley is one of the great masters of fantasy. And here he is writing a completely realistic novel using, in some ways, the same tools and the same kind of luminous attention which elsewhere he brings to the magical, to how a bomber plant runs and how the people live in Henryville. So yeah, fantasist doing realism, temporary wartime freedoms, and also, frankly, the way he writes about sex was illuminating. It's a very warm book about a partly paralyzed gay man who would really like to be, in a kind-hearted, good-hearted kind of way, a seducer. He likes women and he really wants to be in bed with them, and the bomber plant gives him the chance to have the kind of romantic adventures that he always meant to. And they're all his friends. They stay his friends. There is a melancholy to it because they pass out of his life, but none of them regret it. It is a kind of gentle story about several different kinds of liberation going on at the same time. And one more, can I have one more reason why I picked it?
Absolutely.
John Crowley is a kind of exquisite craftsman at the level of the sentence. He sometimes reminds me of one of those kind of a sort of German toy maker with a lens over one eye, painting with a brush no wider than a single hair on his sentences. He's extraordinary, and I feel a kind of maker's envy as I read his sentences.
Have you read many of his books?
I think I've read all of them, except one. There's a late one narrated by a crow called Kaa, which I haven't actually got to yet. His great fantasy is called Little Big and is described by Ursula Le Guin as a book which all by itself calls for a redefinition of fantasy. It's the kind of, how can I put this? It's the 100 years of solitude of fantasy novels. It's a multi-generational story about a very peculiar New England family whose house is bigger on the inside than on the outside. Things happen in the spaces between chapters. People open doors and then don't come back out of them for a couple of hundred pages, and you only get glimpses of what's going on behind the doors. It is an exquisite exercise in frustration, which actually builds an enormous magical power to it. But that's not this book. This book is about a bomber plant.
What are you looking for in a book, in a good read? What is it that draws you to a particular writer and keeps you there?
I have a particular weakness for books that have serious literary ambitions, which are also propulsive in a narrative way. I like the strong forms of story as they've been described. And I like books that want to feed that in me. In some ways, it gives me a kind of continuity with what I loved as a child reading. There is that inevitable moment of confusion and frustration when you emerge, if you're a reading child and you get into the world of adult books, and you discover that even the titles can't be relied on to describe what the contents are. I can remember being 13 or 14 and picking up John Updike's novel The Centaur in a public library and discovering to my real anger that there was no bloody centaur in it. It was just some kind of metaphor. But once you've negotiated that and you learn to see the bigger world of what adult fiction can do, there isn't a chance for story to come back serving kind of richer and more complex ends. So people I admire include Michael Chabon, for example, who is a serious literary novelist who loves the strong forms of fiction and will borrow the superhero comic in The Adventures of Cavalier and Clay, or borrow the kind of rundown, self-hating gumshoe novel in The Yiddish Policeman's Union, as well as writing books that George Eliot would be proud of. I like that crossover. I also like books that do things with history, but do them slant, so you don't know quite what you're going to get, and your sense of both what the novel is going to be and what the history was get altered by reading it. A recent example of this being Zadie Smith's historical novel, The Fraud, which looks as if it's going to be a kind of neo-Victorian many-charactered blockbuster, but then, as if there's a kind of hole in the middle of the floor, drops you into some savage truths about 19th century slavery, and you don't emerge from that unchanged.
I mean, I love the acknowledgement there of what Zadie Smith is doing in The Fraud in terms of a book really about racism in the 19th century, because that's kind of the slyly modern trick that you play in Golden Hill, your debut novel. We're in this 18th century city, which is really at that point not much more than a village, but really it's a story about the origins of sort of racism and capitalism in America. That seems to be a particular conceit of your work, to really be digging into something that is much more profound than the window dressing or the furniture might initially present.
That's partly a question of how the large themes and the large issues actually exist in the world. They don't exist labelled as such on billboards. They are distributed through people's lives. And it seems to me that for fiction to do successfully what fiction does, we ought to happen upon them. We ought to be led towards them and notice them rather than be presented with some kind of monumental construction that obliges us to take notice of them. So Golden Hill is several different things, one of which is a kind of a stranger comes to town novel, classic plot, another of which is a pastiche 18th century novel. But then the great thing about 18th century novels, clunky though they were in some ways in terms of technique, is that nobody yet knew what the rules were. So writing one lets you throw in everything in the kitchen sink. It lets you provide things that later times decided would be completely incompatible pleasures and mix them. And in a mixture like that, that's where it would be natural to suddenly stumble across the truth that New York is a city with slaves in it in 1746, and that Mr. Smith, the protagonist, is perhaps noticing their presence slightly more than other people, but not for reasons that you find out until later on, and that his unknown reason for being there with his unfeasibly large amount of money, which destabilizes the local economy, may also be connected to these people in the corner of the room playing the violin or just kind of staring. Surprise removes familiarity. Surprise, if you do it right, eludes the kind of thick layer of predictability on our responses. Surprise is the thing that lets you see what's really there. This could be very vainglorious. Who am I to say what's really there? But each of the things I put in place in Golden Hill to be noticed eventually were really there in the 18th century. It's the past changes depending on the sieve that each later time applies to it. You notice different things about it. And the 18th century really did include frustrated women, gay men hiding in plain sight, political struggles of a kind that wouldn't really make sense later, but which were very all-encompassing at the time. I was amazed by how royalist New York in the 1740s was, which was delightful because it was like part of the same paradox, which goes, New York, this famously cosmopolitan place. It's got enormous skyscrapers and all the world is represented there. Now, the inverse of that would be a town of 7,000 people, which is anxiously, paranoiacally Protestant and worries enormously about whether you might be a French spy. That kind of reversal of expectation seemed to me to go along with a reversal of other kinds of expectation in the book. I have to confess, all this sounds very noble and artistically ambitious, but actually I'm also just activated by the imp of the perverse, and I enjoy doing unexpected things and being annoying, really.
You're listening to Shelf Life. I'm Aaron Hicklin. I'm talking with Francis Spufford about his new novel, Nonsuch, as well as some of his favourite works. Francis, September the 1st, 1939, by W. H. Auden. He writes this from a New York bar on 52nd Street on the day that Germany invades Poland. He's watching the world slide into catastrophe from across the Atlantic. The poem is part diagnosis and part self-indictment. When did you first read September 1st, 1939?
When I was about 20. But you have to search for it, because Auden himself took against this poem later, so it's not in his selected poems. You have to come across it, at least you did back in the 1980s, in a big, fat, comprehensive collected poems. These days you can just find it online very easily. But then, disfavoured by its poet for reasons I find sympathetic, but I think are just wrong, it was more hidden away. And when I was 20, I'm not sure I understood the kind of the sense of shame that is soaked through so much of the poem, and which gives the affirmation it eventually reaches such power. It's a guilty poem, which nevertheless turns itself back towards hope by an effort of will at the end.
Yeah, that last line, I don't know if you can quote it, but it's the most famous, perhaps.
Oh, here we are. All I have is a voice to undo the folded lie, the romantic lie in the brain of the sensual man in the street, and the lie of authority whose buildings grope the sky. There is no such thing as the state, and no one exists alone. Hunger allows no choice to the citizen or the police. We must love one another or die. Part of Auden's later objection is that he thought, you know, you die anyway. So he proposed a revision, we must love one another and die. But sorry, Whiston, you were right the first time. If you're going to do a clarion call, you must be content to utter a partial truth or one partial truth at a time. It's famous because it takes a time of political failures and murky compromises and idealistic hopes, which turned out, if you were a kind of fellow travelling person in the 30s, like Auden, who had been hoodwinked by Stalin to some extent, that some of what you yourself had signed up for was just as bad as what you opposed, and returns to the kind of the root of things and finds hope in being a citizen, just starting with the basics of kindness and virtue and empathy and gentleness. And I pick it now because this, I'm afraid, is also a moment where a great amount of malignant is clouding the public space. And I suspect we need to remind ourselves that we must love one another or die. And die. All right, yes, in the end, and, but but in the short run, or.
I wonder if you see in your creation, Iris, a kind of call to arms to all of us, and perhaps also in Auden's poem, since he does, in a sense, talk about how the dangerous thing isn't just bombs, it's the idea of a kind of reasonable bargain, you know, compromise.
Yeah. Go along to get along. Well, please understand me if I say I would greatly have preferred this book to be a purely historical novel. It got more and more topical as I was writing it, and I would, in a nanosecond, swap that for a kind of an improved world. But yes, I think times of emergency line up with each other, and there is something in Iris, bad girl, selfish person, person of unscrupulousness, finding that the times require evil to be fought and the good to be served, which applies now and in every other time when bad things are rampant in the streets.
Yeah. Well, I want to end there on that slightly dark note, but I have to end actually instead with a complaint.
Oh.
The novel closes with the words "to be continued." Are you saying I have to wait a full year to find out what fate is in store for the novel's thrilling heroine, Iris, and her paramour?
I'm afraid I am, but it will only be a year. I have written 2/3 of the sequel already. I know where it's going. I am not George R.R. Martin, and the sequel is coming promptly. And it's not a trilogy. It really is only 2 books. So if you like this one and you want the next one and you read the next one, you will get the whole story.
Wonderful. Well, I can hardly wait. Francis, thank you so much for being my guest on this episode of Shelf Life. It's been such a pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you, Aaron.
We've been talking about Nonsuch by my guest, Francis Spufford, published by Simon & Schuster, as well as Four Freedoms, a novel by John Crowley, published by William Morrow, and the poem September 1st, 1939 by W.H. Auden, found in the vintage edition of his collected poems. My thanks as always to my producer Ilya Maritz and sound engineer and composer Tim Wood. Shelf Life is a production of Grand Journal and One Grand Books in collaboration with Radio Catskill. And if you like the show, you can find more episodes on Apple and Spotify with guests such as Jeanette Winterson, Ari Shapiro, William Boyd, and A.M. Holmes. While you're there, please give us a 5-star rating. It will help others find the show.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from the Neversink General Store, featuring catering for parties, meetings, and weddings, gourmet deli, pizzeria, and groceries inside a gas station. NeversinkGeneralStore.com. And from listeners like you.
Next time on City Arts and Lectures, our guest is Richard Powers, Pulitzer Prize-winning author of The Overstory. He'll talk about his new book, Playground, with writer Kim Stanley Robinson. That's next time on City Arts and Lectures on this public radio station.
City Arts and Lectures, this afternoon at 4 on Radio Catskill.
I'm Sabrina Artel. Join me for conversations with all kinds of people in the studio, on the street, and the kitchen table of my vintage travel trailer. That's Trailer Talk, Monday night at 7:30 on Radio Catskill.